We start today's lecture. We will continue with what was seen in the last two or three lectures, which it's related with average complexities. So you've seen so far a couple of examples. One was adding one to a counter. In the worst case, it's linear in the number of digits, but since half of the numbers are even and have a zero in the last position, and half of the remaining ones have a zero in the second position, etc., on average, it's a fast operation. It takes constant time. You've also seen the example of looking for a maximum in an array and looking how many times we change candidates. And the last example that was considered last time was what happens on average on a linear search. We will come to this example now. One thing that could happen is that one may wonder, okay, why would one care about a linear search? If we have an array, we can just sort the elements in the order we want and then perform a binary search. So why would we care about the complexity on average of a linear search? Well, the answer is it's not always integers, the things that we can put in our arrays, and there are many algorithms that in the end are equivalent to a linear search. So for instance, as a motivational example, consider the case where we have some, we want to do some image processing. We receive images from a satellite or whatever, and we want to see if we find aliens on the pictures or faces or whatever, count rocks. And we have different kinds of image processing algorithms. Some work with certain kind of pictures, those that are darker or lighter or more blurry, less blurry, or detect certain kind of alien faces or whatever. So when they give us a picture, we try it with one algorithm after the other until see if some of them detects an alien or whatever. So this is a case of a linear search. We are trying one case after the other. And there's nothing to sort here. We cannot impose an order on these algorithms. So we can keep this as a motivational example. The only assumption we will have to do is that for this image processing thing, for each image, only one of the algorithms will return us something. So this will it's an assumption that simplifies everything. So given this, given a setup like this, we will receive images, things we need to look to perform a linear search. And in the worst case, we know that it will take us n steps, where n is the length of our array, the number of image processing algorithms we know. But we somehow would like to optimize for the average case. If we know that we are receiving, it's more likely that we will receive images of a certain type, which are handled better by some type of algorithm, etc. What can we do to make things better? And this is what was done at the end of the last lecture. The idea is the following. So let's take some notation. So the array elements are 1 to n. So we have an array of size n. We count from 1, etc. So here, the elements could be the image processing algorithms, whatever. And then we have a permutation L. That tells us each of these elements that need to go in the array, in which position of the array there will be. Okay, element 1 is in position 5, etc. And the other element we need is p sub I is the, let's say, small p, is the probability that element I is searched. This is our notation. And what was seen last time by the end of the lecture was the following. So here I'm just doing a recap. An arrangement or permutation, whatever, L is optimal with respect to WRT, with respect to the expected search cost if it satisfies that if the probability of I is greater than the probability of J, then L of I is smaller than L of J. So what this says is, in less mathematical terms, is that the best thing you can do to get the optimal, the better complexity in average is put the elements that are looked more often at the front. Okay? So thanks, Einstein. You can say I wouldn't have imagined. Okay, it's pretty reasonable. We actually saw a proof that this is the case. And the second thing that we okay, this is reasonable. Yes, an arrangement L is optimal arrangement. It's this permutation here. Arrangement is where we put the elements in the array. Is optimal with respect to the expected search cost, right? So expected search cost is on average how expensive will it be to search an element doing a linear search. If it satisfies that when the probability of looking for I is greater than the probability of looking for J, that is, we look for, it's more likely that we will want to find I, that we want to find J, then I is in the array before J. L of I is smaller than L of J. This is the position of the element I in the array. Okay? And there was a second part for this lemma that says that So if we assume that that element one has more probability than element two, etc. And we put element one in position one, element two in position two, etc. Then this tells us precisely what is the expected cost on average for any, for a random search, a search for some, I mean, on a typical case, what will be the cost of doing this? And this is exactly so the optimal cost. Is the sum over all I of the probability of I times I, which is the position of I. Again, this is something one would expect. Now, the thing with this is that it has a pretty strong assumption. It tells us, okay, if you want to know for all this to work, we need to know in advance what elements will be looked for more often. So again, for the case having this application where we want to process images that are sent to us, we may have developed a lot of algorithms that work for different images. We want to make an online tool with that, let people send their photos and we process them. But we don't know what kind of pictures people will send to us. I don't know, what will work? We don't control that. We just have, we will have many linear searches. We will look for faces on pictures, but we don't know what kind of pictures they will send us. So this, in principle, tells us nothing. We don't know what algorithm to put to try first. What should be in the front of our array. So the question is, in that case, can we do anything at all? Is there a better order? What should we do? And the answer is quite interesting. What it says is that a very simple and naive strategy will give us an average performance that is only a small constant away from the optimum average behavior. What is this naive strategy? Well, we can call it the move to front strategy. The idea is simple. We start with the array with any configuration, it doesn't matter. Every time we receive an element to search, we look for it linearly. When we find the position where that element is, we return the value, whatever, but we also rearrange the array. What we do, we move that element to the front and shift all the others to the right by one. Okay, that's as simple as it can get. The idea is that if the element was searched once, we expect that it will be searched again, so we put it at the beginning, just in case. So let's write this. So this is the move to front heuristic. So let's say they ask us to look for element, let's say k. Okay, they say search for element k, please. We do a linear search. And find it in position j. Okay, look for k, we look. Okay, k is in position j. So then what we do is we move k to position 1. And we shift elements from one, from position 1 to j minus 1 to the right. Well, we do this at the same time, right? So we shift and replace by k. Now, notice that this is a form of linear search where every time we search, we also potentially modify the array. Okay, so what's our model of probabilities here of randomness? Well, what we want to what we consider a random array in this case is the configuration we have after having performed many searches. Right, many searches to be performed, and then we looked at the array we get, and we consider that a typical array. So in that case, we want to know for that type of array what's the expected search cost. Now, so how do we tackle this problem? What is the cost of this heuristic? Well, notice that when we search for an element on some at any given time, the number of steps we will have to do depends, so to speak, on the position in the array of the element we are searching for, but the position depends on whether or not it was recently searched in the past. Okay? And for this, we'll to write this properly, we'll need to use this notion. So, assume for a moment that we know that two elements I and j have already been searched for. Okay? The question We know that I will be in the array before J if I was searched for last. If between those two, the last element that was searched for was I. So the question is, what is the probability that I occurs before J in the array? What's that probability? How likely it is that I occurs before J in the array? Let's write this. So again, assume I and J were already looked for. What is the probability, the likelihood that I occurs before J in the array? Well, this is essentially, this is exactly the probability that the last time we looked for one of the two, the one that we looked for was I. Okay? Because of how this heuristic work, if I is before J, it's because the last time we looked for one of the two, the one we looked for was I. That the last time we looked for one of the two, the one we looked for was I. And you may remember from the crash course on probabilities you had last week, I think, that this is a problem of conditional probabilities. Okay, so this is the probability that I was searched for given that I or J was searched for. Okay, so it's everything decided at the point where one of the two was searched for. If I is more likely, if I is more likely to be searched, then we expect to have more probability that it was I. So you might remember that probability. Conditional probability is calculated like this. It's a probability that both events happen together divided by the probability that the conditioning event happens. That was the definition of conditional probabilities. So this is essentially the probability that I was searched for and I or J were searched for divided by the probability that I or J were searched for okay, I'm just using the notion of conditional probabilities. And what is this? What is the probability that we search for I? Well, that we know. We denote it PI. And what is the probability that I was searched for and at the same time I or J was searched for? Well, if I was searched for, then in particularly I or J were searched for. Okay? It's this case implies this case already. So this part here is just the probability that someone searched for I. Okay? And what is this? Well, we should add the additional assumption that I and J are different. Okay, I didn't say it explicitly, but that's what we are looking for. If I and J are different, then these two things are independent. So the probability of searching for one of the two is the sum of the probabilities. Okay? So this formula here answers this question. What is the probability that I occurs before J in the array for two arbitraries, I and J, at some arbitrary execution of point of execution of this algorithm? So now again, let's consider that the algorithm has been running for a while. We search many times and we look at some given array. What do we expect to be the position in the array of some element I, whichever I it is? Well, the expectancy for that is that the position will be 1 plus the number of elements that come before I in the array, which is what we look for here. That will give us an idea of what is the expected position of I in the array. So a second observation is the expected position of I is one plus one, because we are counting from one, the positions of the array, one plus, let's say, the number of elements before I, the expected number of elements before I. So that is, and using this formula here, 1 plus the sum of all j different from I. So all j from 1 to n that are different from I that come before I. So so here I ask the question of what is the probability that I occurs before J. So we get an I here, but now we are looking at the probability, at the likelihood that J comes before I. It's the other way around, so we get a J here. So this means that after running the algorithm many times, we expect that the expected position of I is described by this formula here. It's 1 plus the expected number of elements to the left of I. And from this, we get that so now we can compute what is the expected cost of performing a linear search using this heuristic. On average, how many steps we will have to take to find an element in the array? The expected search cost is, let's call it C for cost and MTF for move to the front. The expected cost for this algorithm is, well, we sum over all possible elements, okay? And for each element, we need to consider how likely it is that the element will be searched for, okay? And in each case, how many steps we will need to compute? Well, that was given by that formula there. This is the expected position of I. So with probability I, so with probability pi, we will have to do these many steps to find it. Okay, what is this? Then we need to start massaging this formula a bit to see if we get something recognizable. Right, so this is, well, let's start by distributing pi here. Just distributed, and now we have the sum over a sum, and we can distribute it also. So this is the sum of all the probabilities plus the sum of all over all I, and then the sum over all j different from I of this ugly term here. Now, the crucial observation is this. Look at this term here. This sums over all I, and then over all j different from I. Okay. So let's fix for a moment a value of I. Let's say that I is 5. And let's fix a value of j. Let's say j is 3. We get this term here, p5 times p3 over p5 plus p3. Okay? And when we take the elements the other way around, when we say I is 3 and j is 5, we get exactly the same term here. Well, because multiplication and addition are commutative. So we get the same value once when we picked 5 and 3, and the other time when we picked 3 and 5. Okay, each element here appears twice. So so each appears twice in the sum, two times. So this is the same as the sum over all I of pi plus two times the sum over all j. And now we say only those that are strictly smaller than I of pi, pj over pi plus pj. Okay, so we are removing a symmetry here. So we now look only the values for j that are strictly smaller than I and count them two times. Just removing symmetries. And this in time is equal to so notice also that now this is grouped like this. Here yes, and now what we do is just factor out this PI. And this here is a probability. It's a conditional probability. So it's at most one. Okay? So we can bound this by one. So this is the sum of pi and what else we know? Well, look, how many numbers are that are smaller than I? Well, at most, but I did something wrong. I missed a 2 on the way. right? These two here, what lost was lost here. So here we got this. So this is a sum over all I of pi. Times 1 plus 2i. And which is just the sum over all I of pi we can directly bound this by 2i. Okay, this is strictly smaller than 2i. So we get this term here and this is just 2 times pi I. And now so we get this as a final bound for the expected cost. And this is sort of funny looking because depending, this depends, so to speak, on how we assign the how we number the elements of the array originally. Okay, so here this talks about, this value here comes from which element we said that was element one in the original array. So for different assignments, for different original assignments, we would get a different value here. Different bounds, but the heuristic in itself has no use for this information, and in the analysis it really doesn't matter the original configuration of the array. What matters in the end is how the searches were performed. So we can assume without losing any generality that the original configuration is the best one, the optimum one, because that's not exploited in the algorithm anywhere, this here. So we can assume without loss of generality that P1 is greater than or equal to P2, etc., P sub n. So that is to say, we can somehow assume that we started with the optimum configuration because the final distribution we get for the average case does not depend on the initial configuration. It's the same. And therefore, using the lemma from the last lecture, we get that the expected cost of this heuristic is two times what we named there as the optimal cost for the average case. So we get as a result so the proof we already did it and the result is the move to front heuristic has an expected search cost. That is at most twice the optimal. Well, some might object that one should also account for the cost of shifting the elements each time, but the cost of shifting the elements is the same as the cost of searching for the element. We can intersperse both, so that would give us at most four times the optimal, but it's not a significant difference. So what this means is that even when we don't know the distribution with which they will perform the searches, we can still have an average performance, which is a constant times the optimum. So that's quite nice. So, okay, we move away now from average complexities, and we will look at one which I personally consider more useful of as a notion, which what is called amortized analysis. And in this case, we are looking not just at the complexity of an individual invocation of a function, of a method, or whatever, but they use several calls of functions and methods over time, and what happens in that case. It helps, I think, to have an intuitive notion of what amortization or amortizing means in this sense. So I'd like to put first a not very algorithmic example, but I think it will show the point. So assume for the moment that I work as a clerk. I have a job. I have my desk here, and people queue in front of me. And each person that comes brings me a form. Okay, my job is to receive the form, enter it in the computer, and give him a receipt. When I give him the receipt, the guy can leave and the next one comes. And I actually seen this in some places. When the guy leaves, there are two buttons that say, are you satisfied with the way that this person worked? And you can press yes or no. It's like on Amazon, but with people. So that's my job. It's boring, that's what I have to do. And also I have this problem, which is they want to give me incentives. They tell to me, okay, we will pay you more if you have very good evaluations. If you have more than 90% of satisfaction answers from the people, we pay you more money. And then, if you have more good ratings, more money we pay you. So I see this problem that I have, that it takes me, I don't know, 2 minutes to enter each form on the computer, and people is impatient, so for them 2 minutes is too much. So half of the time they just press no because they had to wait for 2 minutes. So then I decide to do as follows. I change the way I work. So now every time someone comes, gives me the form, I put it here, give him the receipt, thank you, sir, and the guy is very happy. It was immediate, 1 second. So he leaves and gives me a positive evaluation. The second guy comes, I do the same. Put his form here, the receipt, he's happy with the evaluation. He's happy and gives me a good evaluation. I keep doing this until the guy number 100 arrives. So he gives me his form, and I say, please hold on a sec, and I start entering the stack of 100 formulas I have here, one after the other. It takes me like 2 hours. Yes, please, sir. The guy is crazy. When I finish entering all, I give him the receipt. He's, of course, furious, give me a very bad evaluation, and leaves. So is this better or worse? I think it's very better for me, because now I have 99% of good evaluations, right? All except the last guy are very happy. So I get more money. And in a way, I'm making one guy very miserable, but I can afford to do that because I already made 99 guys happy. From my point, it's good. But so there's some amortization going on there, but the kind of amortization that will be critical for us is the following. From the point of view of the management, am I being less efficient than before? So I'm changing the way I'm working. I'm doing something strange. I'm delaying work until the end. But I'm less efficient. The time I need to enter 1,000 formulas, did it change? No, it's exactly the same. So I need 2 minutes per formula. And in one case, I was using those 2 minutes one by one. The formula comes, I spend 2 minutes entering it. And in the other scenario, I do it all in the end. It takes me each formula 2 minutes. So the total time I spent entering formulas is the same. I'm not less efficient. And what this means is that I'm not less efficient because all the time I waste on the 100th guy entering all the formulas, I already saved it on the 99 before. I could have used the time differently, a fraction each formula could have been managed every time, and it would have taken me exactly the same amount of time. And that is the notion of amortizing we will use, which one must insist, it's something that one does. So maybe some has the intuition that one says, okay, amortizing means, the first guy comes and I want to make a coffee, so I say, wait, I go and make me a coffee, drink, and then I say, okay, now I will work faster because I had a coffee, so the time I lost with this guy, I will compensate it afterwards. That doesn't work. So for amortization to be useful, whatever time we spend, extra time we spend doing something, like entering the 100 formulas, we need to have saved it before. So this is more like saving money for using it later. So let's see an example, a typical example of amortized analysis. And this is the example of the unbounded array, or a vector of infinite size, not infinite, but unbounded size. This is a structure that looks like an array. We have the operations of an array. We can access elements in certain position, and we want access to be in constant time. Access needs to be fast. But unlike a typical array, we want to be able to add elements and remove elements from the back. Okay, so we can start with an unbounded array of size 5, and then extend it to 5, 10, whatever. And we always want to be able to access elements fast. This, I guess, is a data structure that you probably have seen in the past or used. So what's the idea? How can we implement such a structure? Well, we use dynamic arrays allocated with malloc or new or whatever, and we guess, so we have an initial size, and we use that array until we need to put more elements in it. It's not large enough. In that case, we need to create a larger array, copy all elements from the old array to the new array, and continue from there. And we also want to be space efficient. So at some point, when we notice that we have a very large array allocated, but are only keeping a relatively small number of elements, we want to shrink it. Get a smaller array, copy all the elements there, and throw away the old large array. So let's give the code for such a structure so that we can reason clearly about it. I will be using the notation that was introduced a couple of weeks ago. So we are creating a data type. So I'm using this class syntax. And we need two constants that will regulate the behavior of this class. One is every time we need to get more space, because our array is not large enough, how much more space do we ask? We will regulate that with a constant beta, which we set to 2. And this is the growth factor. And we'll have another constant which we call alpha, which we set to 4. And this gives us the it's the worst case. Memory blow up. We will use it to decide when it's time to shrink the array, when the array is too large. So then we will keep 2 fields. W is the length of the array. We'll keep another variable n, which says this is an internal array, the length of the internal array. N is the length of the array from the outside, how many elements we have added to that array, how many elements we believe that our class, our instance of uArray has. This is the current size of the unbounded array, if you want. We are interested in maintaining an invariant. I mean, we assume that all the time it will hold that the current size is not larger than the size of the physical array where we keep the elements. And also, we don't want the internal array to be too large. So it can be at most 4 times the real number of elements. Well, that's in general. Otherwise, we have no elements. This is a corner case. It's not very, really important. And finally, the field we need is the actual array. So those are the fields of our data type. Well, we have some operations which are simple. For instance, we want to have an operator for dereferencing, getting some elements of the array. So this is the operator brackets. And the precondition is that the element is in range. And we just return the value. It one is easy. So let's do one more interesting. We want to have a method to add a new element at the back of the array. We want to increase the size by 1. So this gives us the new element. Now, there are two possible cases. Either we still have free space on this array, or we don't. If we don't have free space, we need to get a larger array. So that's the first check we need to do. And we will use an auxiliary method for that, which we call reallocate. We will write it in a moment. And we pass the new size for the array. So essentially, this says we need to reallocate, and the new size should be 2 times the current size. We get twice as much space. And after that, we just assign this to the new position. Okay. And we increment the number of elements. And we have a similar operator, which is to remove an element to the back. We call it pop back. And of course, this one has a precondition. We need to have at least one element. And we do as follows. First, we just decrease the number of elements. And then we need to make sure that this holds. By decreasing the number of elements, it could happen that now the array we have is too large. We are wasting too much space. If that's the case, we need to shrink it. So we say that if and look, the way we shrink it is we ask for a new array which is twice the number of elements that we really have. Okay, so maybe we are, so what will happen is that when we do a, if this is our physical array and this part is the one that was being used, okay? When we decide that this array is too large, it's more than 3/4 are being wasted, we shrink it to this size, one where only half of the elements of the array are wasted. This is what we are doing here. And finally, we need to write this reallocate procedure. So so we create a new array. We allocate an array. And what we do is copy the n elements that we had in B to the new array B prime. So I will use this funny notation. this amounts to doing a for loop that copies n elements from B to B prime. We throw B away and set B to the new array. So it is clear that this operator here runs in constant time, always, worst case. And the worst case complexity of pushback and popback is also linear in the size of the array, linear on n. Okay? So worst case, linear time operations, but we want to look at what happens over time when we use pushback and popback many times. And what we get is that over many operations, many pushbacks and popbacks, we amortize the copying that sometimes we have to do in a way such that in the end, we can think of all operations as constant time. Let's write this precisely. So the unbounded array implements pushback and popback in amortized constant time . That means what it means precisely to have amortized constant time. That means that any sequence of pushback or popback on an unbounded array which is initially empty takes theta of m . So this says pushback and popback are implemented in amortized constant time, and this means that if we start with an initially empty unbounded array, and we apply m of these operations, m pushbacks and m popbacks in any order, then the total time of doing all those m operations is theta of m. So the time is linear on the number of operations. So in the end, we can say that it's constant once we amortize it. If all the operations were constant, if all pushbacks and popbacks were constant, this will take the same time. So in that sense, we say that it's amortized constant time. And the question is, how do we prove this? And well, the typical method, it's called the bank account method or the potential method. And the idea is as follows. We associate to each instance of unbounded array a bank account, or you can think a jar when one puts coins, okay? And there's one operation which takes non-constant time, and that is reallocation. Reallocation doesn't run in constant time. So we need to pay for reallocations. Every time here we copy an element from B to B prime, we need to pay. We pay one coin or one token, whatever. That means every time we call reallocate, we need to have in our bank account enough coins to pay for all the movements. And we take them from our account. We remove them from the jar. And who pays for those operations? Well, the calls to pushback and popback need to pay for that. That means that every time we execute a pushback, we need to put a certain amount of coins in the jar. And every time we execute a popback, we need to put also coins in the jar, in this account. And what we need to prove is that the number of coins that we put every time we do a pushback or a payback is always enough to pay for the relocations. And if the number of coins we put each time is constant, that means that in the end, it's all as if we had performed these relocations every time we paid. That's the main intuition. We are performing some work which we could have performed with constant steps before. So let's write the proof. So we use the bank account method. So the first observation, look at the calls to reallocate. It's called both in pushback and in popback. And both times, it's called with parameter beta n, which is essentially 2n. OK? So that means that every time we need to perform a reallocation, we need to copy exactly n elements. That's a property of the way we are calling reallocate. In every call, we call it with 2n as a parameter, and we need to save the n parameters we had. So that means that for each call to reallocate, we need to pay n coins. N because it's n things we are copying. So we pay n tokens for each reallocate. And we assume, and here it's where we are using creativity, so we assume that pushback deposits, so each call to pushback deposits two tokens. And each call to popback one token. Why two tokens and one tokens? Well, because they will work, and we will see why during the argument. So now we need to show that every time we call reallocate, we have enough tokens. Okay, so the first time we call reallocate is because we added at least one element. So we had to have added two elements. The first one, because we start with size one. So if we look at the way it's initialized, originally we have, I didn't put it, we need to give initial values to W. So yeah, these are 1 and 0. Yeah, otherwise it's not initialized. So initially we have an array of only one element. So we had to put something there and try to put a second element in the amounted array, and then we will need to call reallocate. And the first element we put there already paid two tokens, and we need to copy one element, so we have enough. This is because pushback was called more than once, and we need, and we have n equals 1 and at least 2 tokens. Why at least? Could we have more? Yes, we could have more. We could have that our sequence was push, pop, push, pop, push, pop, push, push. So we have like 10 tokens and only one thing to move. So it's OK. So this case is OK. And now an observation. Immediately after of calling reallocate, because of this, we have that the array is twice as large as the number of elements. That's because we are calling it both times with the same parameter, with 2n. So immediately after calling reallocate, and this is any call to reallocate, not the first one. Whenever we call reallocate, immediately after, we have that W is n over 2. Okay, the array is twice as large as the number of elements. And if we call reallocate again, that is two possibilities. Possibility one, we need many pushbacks and we need more space. Possibility two, we need many popbacks and we need to shrink the array. So that is because either n is w, the array is filled, or alpha times n, so this is 4 times n, is smaller than w. This is many pushbacks, many popbacks. We need to increase, we need to decrease. In the first case, we had, that means that we were originally with this situation. So it is necessary that there were n over 2 new pushbacks. We had to add n over 2 new elements to fill it. And each addition paid 2 coins, 2 tokens. So we get so we have at least n tokens, because each addition paid 2. And this is OK. So from this case to this case, we had to have n over 2 additions. Each addition paid 2, so we have n tokens, and n tokens pay for the relocation. And in the second case, we moved from someone should have interrupted me. This here makes no sense, right? So this is the other way around. It's the size of the array was twice as large as n, okay? Or equivalently, now here it is. The size of the array is twice as large as n. Okay, so we have that W is I need to go to sleep, sorry. So N is W over 2. Okay, and so that means that here we added to get from N being this to N being W, we added n have 2 elements. We added w over 2 elements. Okay, and so here we have at least W tokens. Okay, for each of these we pay 2, so we have W tokens, but W is N because we are considering this case. So we have enough tokens in that case. So in the second case, we originally have this amount of elements, and we have removed. And this is the bound. This is the point where we shrink. We are here. So this means that we have to remove at least W times 4 elements. This is the number of popbacks we had to make to get from here to here. Okay. So this is the difference. How many elements we had after the previous reallocate and how many elements we have now, and this is how many popbacks we had to do. And each popback paid 1. So we have at least 4 tokens, and we need N, which is smaller than or equal to W times 4. I'm just dividing by 4 here. So in this case, we have at least W divided 4 tokens. Each time was paid by one of these popbacks. And we need to have N, but N is, because we are in this case, at most W times 4. Okay. We continue with this example next time. One thing which is you might want to think about is that in this example, these values here are important. If one changes 4 for a 2 to save memory more often, everything breaks. You should be able to find an example easily. Okay, thank you.